Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And some of you may know that Love Letters Live is about just that, love letters, and the moments in our life that evoke a feeling that lets us write a love letter to someone, to anyone, for any reason at all. And today's guest is going to present a whole new reason. And I'm going to introduce you to Meredith May. And Meredith, tell us what you do.
I'm a writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm also a teacher of journalism at Mills College, and I'm an urban beekeeper.
Okay, I know that's going to be the focus of this, but tell us, please, just start talking about your upbringing and your childhood. I know you're writing a memoir, so start wherever you want and talk about how you were raised and who raised you. And
I grew up in Carmel Valley, and in my grandparents' house, and I was raised by my grandparents.
For some particular reason?
A very typical reason. My parents divorced when I was four, and we were on the East Coast at the time. My father was in the Navy in Rhode Island, so he stayed back, and my mom got on a plane and took my younger brother and I, and she didn't know what to do. She was young, and she moved back into her childhood bedroom, basically.
Which was where?
In Carmel Valley.
Oh,
so she moved
so
into
was
her parents.
Home with
she
you.
Came home.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but the three of us moved into one bedroom, and she really just sort of fell into a depression that she never quite came out of. So the job fell to
So in a natural
grandpa.
Way.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. And they must have been wonderful people.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. I mean, it was a really idyllic and sad, you know, childhood at the same time.
Sad from discomfort for your mother or discomfort among other children?
I think sad because I always felt like sort of parentless. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like I knew I was different than the other kids in school. And, you know, I would take grandpa to school on take your dad to school day.
I
and
see.
I was always a little different, even though it was the 70s and divorce
was
really
ask.
High.
Yes, yes. Because that's not like the 50s or something.
Right,
yeah.
Right. But I grew up in a place, it was very wealthy, and at least the outward appearances of a lot of the families of my friends were that they had it all together. And
I'm wondering if they thought that about you.
Probably. Probably.
Because those outward appearances, you know, you look back sometimes at your high school friends or grammar school friends, any early friends, and think they had it all together, and they're falling apart in a million ways.
Exactly, exactly. And at the same time, I had this grandfather. He's a third-generation beekeeper himself.
Oh, okay. I want you to talk about beekeeping. Yeah.
And so I was his apprentice, and it was just a wonderful world to escape
into. Say what you can about beekeeping, because every once in a while, there was that book and the movie, The Secret Life of the Bees, and you don't hear too much about beekeeping.
Well,
I think most people are hysterically frightened of bees.
I find two things. You're either hysterically frightened, and then I love it because then I'm going
to
bring you to my hive immediately and get
you
over that.
Okay.
Or people are immediately fascinated. Bees are really trendy right now. You know, there's a lot of concern over
hive abandonment. It's terrible. Yes.
Yep. There's a lot of concern over colony collapse disorder and, you know, resurrecting the bee and making bee sanctuaries. So New York just finally allowed urban beekeeping. It was outlawed there for a while. So there's a network of urban beekeepers. And, you know, I find that when I tell people I do it, all of a sudden, you know, if they're not scared and want to, I've had people like actually walk away from me because they're so frightened of bees.
You don't have a stinger.
That was funny.
That is odd.
But most of the time, people are fascinated.
So you live in San Francisco. Do you live in an apartment? I mean, most people.
I do.
And you keep bees in San Francisco.
Yeah, I keep them on the roof of the Chronicle, though.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I'm using the first person a lot here. I do it jointly with the home and garden editor, Deb Wandell. She and I are the bee wranglers at the Chronicle.
Do you take visitors?
Yeah, all the time. Every week we get requests.
I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I am frightened of bees. I mean, when one comes, if I'm at a restaurant sitting outside and there are bees, I go inside.
Usually, that's good.
Usually with a little bit of a huffy attitude.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you swat at the bees?
No, because because my father told me, I was raised with, they're wonderful, lovely, busy, important creatures. And if you don't bother them, they won't bother you. They're not out to, you know, they've got better things to do than harass you.
Yeah, they.
And even with that.
They don't want to sting you. Mm-hmm. Because they know that if they do, that means they're going to die.
Oh,
because when the stinger comes out, it takes out their internal organs.
Oof.
And they're done for.
And
they
know
this.
That?
So they do not want to sting you. And in fact...
So it's a last resort?
It is. It's sort of like a sacrifice for the rest of the colony.
Oh, I'm just going to cry.
What they'll do, if you're... if they're irritated, they'll come up to you and actually headbutt you. They'll like dive bomb into you, telling you to back up. They'll give you warning signs. And if you learn how to read bees, you're much less likely to get stung. But the thing everybody does wrong, and I'm so glad I'm on this program because this is the one thing I want to say, is a lot of people's instinct is to, you know, yell and swat. Like, oh, get away from me. Like that. And bees do not like loud noises. And they don't like sudden movement because they see infrared. So if you wave your hand in front of a bee, they're going to get this trippy LSD infrared sight.
It's just torture
it
to them.
It scares them. They think bears are getting in their hive. They think they're being attacked. So if you just, like you do, walk away and don't make any noise.
You know, I thought everybody knew not to swat at them because every once in a while I'm with people and somebody will do that. And I scream, don't hit.
Yeah, or just don't make a
sudden movement.
Just walk
away.
And the other thing, the other tip is when you're standing in front of a hive, you can see there is a flight pattern coming in and out. Don't stand in the middle of it. That is their pet peeve.
Okay, so talk about your grandfather
okay.
and why, if you know why he went into this and...
Oh,
what
I
do. Your training was. You just go ahead.
Yeah. It's very interesting. His father and his uncle, he grew up in Big Sur and Pacific Grove.
Mm-hmm.
His father and his uncle had hives at the monastery on Big Sur. They kept hives there. And in the garden that the nuns kept.
For honey production?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was a good place because there's a lot of wildflower and sage along the Big Sur coast. So they asked the monastery and they had an arrangement, the Carmelite Monastery. And then during World War II, when a lot of their neighbors in Pacific Grove were being taken away to Japanese internment camps.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a favor to their neighbors, they put hives on the front porches of the abandoned houses so that they wouldn't get robbed.
Oh, so,
yeah,
okay. At the
because
same
people like you would probably not rob it.
a watch bee.
And then, so that's how Grandpa learned. He would go along with his dad to install the hives. And then he just took it up as a, you know,
was
teenager.
That his profession, actually?
One of them. He was also a plumber.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So my grandfather then inherited his father's hives, and he also worked a deal with the Big Sur Land Trust to keep his hives along the coast in Big Sur.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like the Big Sur beekeeper. He's the only
what
one.
What is his name?
Franklin Peace.
Mm-hmm. P-E-A-C-E.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lovely name for a
I know.
Frank Peace.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I never thought of it that way, Frank Peace.
Yeah.
Because he usually goes by Franklin. But
That's
poetic justice,
isn't
it?
I guess so, yes.
And then Grandpa, in the backyard of the house I lived in, within the backyard of his house, he put an old army bus, and that was his honey extraction room. So he ripped out all the seats and... somehow hooked up the extractor that spins the honey out to the engine of the bus and turn it on. So I would go in there and process honey with him.
So you process it and you collect it and you bottle it and you everything from
bee
to the store?
Well, he has this whole Willy Wonka setup of plumbing parts that would pump the honey from the extractor and then straight over a 50-gallon barrel. It would just drip through cheesecloth. Honey is
It sounds like a
super
kind of
sanitary
a...
product. What am I trying to say? Not antiseptic. Anyway, it's clean.
Yes.
Like
they non-bacterial.
Found, yeah, it's uh-huh. anti. Thank you, antibacterial. Mm-hmm. They found honey in Egyptian tombs, perfectly intact.
Oh,
so yeah, you don't have to actually. You can just bottle.
Oh, so
it.
So you're saying you don't have to do anything like you do with milk or pasteurizing? Yeah, or it's pure when it comes out. What does it take to get one jar of honey? In terms of how many bees, I don't know if you know that, but I'm just curious.
I could kind of figure that out if I did some math, but. Something like one bee, mm-hmm. her whole life,
uh-huh.
produces an eighth of a teaspoon of honey.
Oh, that's
it's
what
really
okay.
tiny.
It sounds like it must be because they're really tiny.
Yes.
So this is a huge job.
Yeah.
And messy, I guess. I mean, sticky.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
So, you talk about you and like what you do. And what values did you learn in this?
Well, that is an enormous question for me because I'm just discovering it. I always wanted to be a beekeeper. I just needed a space and a place to do it. And
because you related to it so easily from what you were being taught? Or is there some genetic component you think that...
I want to carry on the family tradition.
Oh, okay, so that's nice.
And I want to be part of helping resurrect the honeybee. And I just think it's cool. It's so, unusual.
I was going to just ask you about that. So for a child who grew up feeling a little skittish about being different,
yeah,
you seem to have settled real comfortably into being different because you've chosen something that is different, and you're happy about it.
Well, I think I figured out why I'm doing it, really, just recently, because we bottled our first harvest at the Chronicle. And we were in the kitchen, and there must have been... 40 people there, photographers, videographers, editors, other people who are just curious who came by, all the chefs, the food critics. And it came time to pull the lever at the bottom of the barrel. We'd been spinning all morning for about 4 hours, and someone handed me the jar. Like, I was given the honor of holding the jar, which I thought was really special.
It's like childbirth here.
And that first drop came out, and yes. That kitchen is always loud. There's boisterous kitchen. That kitchen was like 3 a.m. quiet. And the drop came out, and all the cameras are focused on it. And I just almost dropped it. It's a glass jar. I almost dropped it. And I almost started crying because I felt, oh, this is my family. This ties me to a parent and a legacy.
Oh,
and it
yes.
was really big for me.
Yes.
And very private moment in public. And so my love letter is actually a 184-page memoir that I've been working on for the last couple of years. So it's
now, are your grandparents still living?
They are.
Oh,
yeah.
How wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh.
Granny is, I believe, 90, mm-hmm. and Grandpa's 84.
Oh, they must be so thrilled with you.
Some days, on other days, you know, I'm not doing what they want me to do,
okay,
like typical
just like any parents.
Parents, yeah.
But I'm just so touched by this whole story. Well, so in terms of love letters, and I'm glad you brought it up because is this memoir almost done?
That it is in first draft. It was my thesis for my MFA that I recently got, and so it's. School done, but it's not New York
done. So you still got
done.
Work to do on it.
Yeah, I'm restructuring it and I'm making it awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's
I
good,
bet.
But
by the way,
it needs
for
to
those
be
of
awesome.
You, I want to just may I say something about your writing?
You can say whatever you want.
For those of you who have not had the pleasure of reading Meredith's writing in the Chronicle, I think can you give a website where they she writes in such a personal. Loving, very insightful, with eye toward detail that makes insight and loving complete. It's just a pleasure. It's just a pleasure. So can you give a website where people could find your Chronicle writing?
Yeah.
At SF Gate or something?
Yeah, I will if you will be my agent.
Oh, okay. Yes. Do I
All
just
right.
have to say this again? I would love to. I am such a fan of your writing. And the subjects you choose,
I choose
are just wonderful.
Yeah.
Again,
well,
a little different.
People can go to MeredithAMay.com.
Oh, good. Let's spell it. M-E-R-E-D-I-T-H-A-M-A-Y. M-A.
Oh, sorry. Oh, there's an A
then,
in between.
Then you spell it out, because one letter off, they won't find you.
Okay. It's MERED-ITHAMAY.com.
So worth doing. Your grandparents are still alive.
Yeah.
And I don't know how long it will take for you to complete this book, but do they know about it, I'm guessing?
If they listen to this, they will.
Oh, so he doesn't yet.
No. I want to let them know if it's going to happen. I mean, mm-hmm. I right now in the writing process, it feels really important to be private about it.
Okay, so what you're writing.
They don't have the internet. So
you feel that what you're writing should be private now, but not necessarily that you're thinking of them in this way.
Correct.
Okay, so I have a thought, because I always feel that a love letter, there's so many things that can be love letters, and I did an article recently on food as a love letter. Mm. Sure, why not? It evokes all the same thinking of somebody else, giving someone else what he or she needs, doing it beautifully. But there's something about having something in your handwriting that is gold. How would you feel, because if you don't do it, I will.
Okay.
How would you feel about writing them a letter and telling them that you're thinking of them in this way and that your goal is to honor them and how they raised you and what they gave you by publishing this memoir about your childhood?
Yeah, I think that's great. I think they would really like it. I would address it to Grandpa, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I said grandparents. Yes, of course, since it's, yes. And to have something really specific from you in your handwriting. And I always think of something else also, which is 100 years from now. Mm. Someone will find that first edition book and find your letter tucked away in it. And I don't know if you have, are you an only child?
I have a younger brother.
Okay. I don't know if you have nieces or nephews.
I do.
Uh-huh. Okay. So somebody of another generation will find this, and maybe their children will find it. And you know, when you find love letters 100 years old or 50 years old, it's such a legacy and it's such a lesson in where these people come from. I mean, they'll know that their Aunt Meredith was a woman who loved in a certain serious way. They'll know something about you. It's part of their pedigree.
Yeah,
what do you think?
As a writer, if I stumbled across something like that for my family, I would, you know, love it.
Yes.
And I think in this time of tweet, text,
mm-hmm.
writing letters is important.
Yes.
We need to exercise that muscle again.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. And you know, then you've sent something that's felt the touch of your hand,
right?
Which email doesn't.
Right.
As much as I love email, I'm totally addicted to it. And it's wonderful for so many things, and texting is wonderful for urgency.
Right.
But somebody pointed out something to me that I want everybody to think about, is that technology changes. I would say, you know, every 12 minutes, but certainly every several years, and you can't play your Betamax movies.
Mm.
You won't be able to play your VCRs on anything very soon. That stuff corrodes
mm-hmm.
and won't last.
Right.
And while we're playing our DVDs, we're going to be outdone by Blu-ray, and those will be useless.
Right.
So, but we have letters from 150 years ago, signed by Marie Antoinette, and
yep. I heard they just found a bunch of hers.
Did they?
Yeah.
Oh.
I was reading a story in The New Yorker, and a bunch of her letters were just been discovered.
Oh, interesting. I was only aware of one, actually, but that's exciting.
Yeah.
And that's how we know about real history.
And it forces us to think.
Yes.
I mean, it's not... We're all about expediency in it right now,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's a little scary. Maybe we need to slow down and think about what do we really want to say.
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you said that, and completely.
Yeah.
You know, I heart you doesn't do it.
Right.
You know, and for a love letter, it's the specifics. It's why I love you, what I remember about you. And I have a feeling that this will amaze your grandfather. I bet he'll see things that you remember and that you were aware of that he didn't know you remembered. Do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, he's my bee coach right now, and I call him on the phone every once in a while because he's He retired this year. The hives are just too heavy. They can weigh like 60 pounds, one of those boxes. So I call him and he tells me what to do. Or if I say, oh, I saw this today, or the queen's acting a little weird, or I describe
So it's
things.
Obvious who's the queen and who takes the different roles because they
look different. Yeah. So he's my consultant. And, you know, he said to me that he's really happy I'm doing this. It keeps him, even though he retired from it, it keeps him in it, you know. And some of his methods and remedies are very old-fashioned, but they
and
work.
You like,
They work, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Tell me something else about this hive resurrection. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think people are not so, some people may not be so aware that we need these bees for pollinating. I mean, if they all go away, we do without an awful lot of our foods.
Right.
Is that...
Right. Yeah, it's something like every fourth bite that we put in our mouths has been pollinated
so what
by honeybees.
What
so
would we do without?
We'd be in big trouble. We'd have
but
to...
But which foods, for example?
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
I grew up with avocado trees, and I knew they were male and female, and that you needed avocado wasps to pollinate.
Yeah, well, almond trees, watermelon, cantaloupe,
watermelon,
cucumber, tomato, everything, just about. Yeah, and so what's been happening that's scaring people is they're calling it, it's a generic term, colony collapse disorder. And big commercial beekeepers are opening their hives and there are no bees.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, and these are the beekeepers, they're not the urban small town beekeepers like us, but these are the commercial guys who load up semis with stacks and stacks of beehives and drive them to agricultural fields. And once their bees, you know, a month pollinate a certain field, they truck them to
somewhere
else.
Oh, so that's a separate business. It's like you get your lend your bees out.
Right, you rent your bees.
Oh, right, sure. Yes.
And so those were the guys who were experiencing collapse, not hobbyists. I mean, occasionally, but the real problem was being noticed in these big operations. So, and there are a bunch of factors and forces and theories.
What are they?
The main one is that a lot of those fields are pollinated with pesticide.
Oh.
So the bees are taking that pollen and that nectar back into the architecture
of
their
really
honeycomb.
Being, really being poisoned.
Yeah, it's like us living in a lead paint house for too long. So there's been a lot of talk about being more aware of that and trying to use more.
Is there time to reverse that?
I don't know. Is it, it's at least the conversation is started, and some commercial beekeepers are not sending them to pesticide fields. And then there's just the ever troublesome mites and moths and all kinds of bugs.
Infections, so it's a physical thing
that the bees can get. So, yeah, and the other theory is that we're working bees to death. Like
that's
trucking them to field after field after field is really unnatural.
Okay, so that's what I meant by it's just, so it's not just physical. I mean, it's more of a...
Yeah, it's that we're messing with nature too much for our own profit.
Well, I think that's generally true.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that in itself is, you know, colony collapse has inspired a lot of people to take up beekeeping on their own to try to restore the populations and just let them go to whatever flowers they want.
Oh, so you might do this.
So that's part of that's part of the renaissance in independent beekeeping right now, is to try to counteract commercial colony collapse.
Let's talk just for a minute and get back to the love letter you're going to write to your grandfather. What, just as an example of how to start and what to include for our listeners, what will you say to him? What are the things you want him to know?
I want him to know that he made a big impression on me. I would thank him for bringing me into the honey bus as a girl and showing me, you know, the magic of a beehive and how to make honey, for passing on a skill, like a sacred skill. I mean, it's not just a nice hobby. It's something that's really important to make sure we can still eat in the future.
Yeah.
So it's something I take with a lot of responsibility and humility. I would thank him for teaching me to ride a bike, for bringing me to Big Sur all the time when I was a little kid. And that is my special place. That's where I go when I need to unwind. And I'm sure as a lot of people do. Uh-huh. But I sort of, because I know him and because he's either related to or friends with a lot of the founding families down there, I've been able to see it from behind the curtain kind of view. Mm-hmm. And so I would thank him for giving me that.
Yes.
You know, I'm really tied to that land and the people there.
I'm so touched by the fact that just listening to you, it seems like somehow through him, finding your way to the hives brought you home.
Exactly.
And that the hive in some way is a home to you.
It is.
And you have such a feel for the residents of the hive, almost like...
No, that's exactly where my book is headed, and how it wraps up. And the other thing that I would thank him for, and I didn't know that this was going to happen, but because he taught me beekeeping and because I held it in my bones until I turned 40 and then started doing it myself, it's opened me up to a world of foodies and chefs and just writers. Maxine Hong Kingston called and wanted to meet the bees. Yes. And she's one of the writers I studied in school. And so I'm meeting all these really interesting people. I met a lot of the editors at Sunset Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And then they invited me to cover some of their food and wine festival events.
So you found your way home in more than one way.
Yeah. So I've met so many interesting, wonderful people because they're fascinated with the bees. I'm fascinated with the bees. Yeah. And it's like my world opened up. It got so much larger.
Well, yes, it's a point of access for so much, it seems like. Oh, that is so lovely.
Yeah. And I work in the main office of the Chronicle, the food and garden writers, they have a separate building. So the beehives are on top of the roof of the food and garden building. We've got a rooftop garden. But now I spend a lot more time over there. And, you know, I've discovered, they have communal lunch together on Wednesdays.
Oh, so your life has just become richer in every possible way. Oh, how wonderful for him to know this.
You know, they sit down together as a staff. There's about 15 or 20 of them, and they eat things that, you know, Lynn and Sarah made that day in the kitchen. And it's like this beautiful place. You come in, and there's always something cooking in the kitchen, and people are nice, and they sit down and sample.
So you have a lot to write in a letter.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Oh, so it'll be like a preview of what's coming. So he'll know now that this is in your heart.
Right.
So I am curious about one other thing. Well, I know that you'll do this as soon as you can, a letter to him.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you'll hear from him. Well, you'll find out. Because sometimes, you know, people get letters and they're so touched that they're almost mute. And they don't respond for a long time.
Yeah.
But we send love letters just as a gift. So thank you so much for telling us about this.
You're welcome. I've learned
so much about bees and a little bit more about you.
I know. And I'll put you in a suit and then get you closer to
them. I want to do
that. Yeah, we'll put gloves on and a hat and everything so they can't even get you.
Okay. I won't. If I'm standing next to you, I won't worry about them.
Okay.
I really not. I mean, my fear is, partly of ignorance, but now I'm so horrified at the torture they go through.
Yeah.
In other words, I'm thinking only of myself here and that they might sting me, and who knows what that feels like because I've never been stung. But just to know what's on their side.
Yeah.
Yes, I will be ever changed in how I looked at that. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, that's all for today. I wish this were a television moment because you should see the smile on this beautiful woman's face. And I wish we could talk some more, but we can't because our time is up. So this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye for now. And please remember, I haven't said this for a while, that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, please remember that writing a love letter is a special occasion. Bye.